Welcome to the debate. So I want you to imagine that you are lost at sea. Having a perfectly calibrated compass is, well, it's absolutely essential, right? It points you to true north. It guarantees you know the difference between, you know, actually heading toward your destination and just sailing wildly off course.
Right, yeah. It gives you orientation in an otherwise completely featureless ocean.
Exactly. But orientation is not navigation. A compass won't build the hull of your ship.
No.
It doesn't tell you how to rig the sails to catch a crosswind or, you know, how to calculate the displacement of water so you don't sink. If you only have a compass, you know exactly where you want to go, but you have no engineering, no operational mechanism to actually get there.
You're just floating. You're just floating.
And today we are looking at a brilliant philosophical compass and asking, you know, how do we finally build the ship? We are diving into Bashara Sahali's 2026 academic white paper, Completing the Life Value Onto Axiology Program.
Which, let's be honest, is a very heavy title for a paper that is essentially trying to solve a very practical, very urgent global crisis.
It is, yeah. To ground this for everyone listening, Sahali's paper is a direct response to the foundational work of the philosopher John McMurtry. So decades ago, McMurtry established this concept called life value onto axiology, or LVOA.
Right.
McMurtry basically gave us the compass. He established a primary axiom asserting that value, true value, is defined purely by what enables coherently inclusive ranges of thought, felt being, and action. Value is not defined by monetary proxies. It is not defined by corporate profit or institutional throughput.
Right. McMurtry correctly identified what he called the life ground. But the central tension we are examining today is what happens when we try to take that beautiful, open philosophy and turn it into a rigid operational blueprint.
Precisely. The core question is this. Can an open framework like LVA be successfully translated into a structured operational architecture, complete with minimal grammars and strict decision procedures, without calcifying into the very rigid, life-blind doctrine it's trying to cure?
Exactly.
And I stand firmly with the paper's thesis. I argue that without a rigorously falsifiable operational architecture, LVA just remains an abstract compass. It's completely incapable of guiding real-world institutions. We need Sahali's translation engine.
And I approach this operationalization with, well, profound skepticism. While the intent is noble, obviously noble, I argue that codifying subjective lived experience into six-layer architectures and lexical decision rules risks massive metric gaming.
Metric gaming?
Absolutely. I fear it reduces the profound meaning of human life to just, you know, a shiny new form of technocratic measurement.
Okay, well, let's start with why Sahali felt he had to write this paper in the first place. We have to recognize the absolute necessity of what he calls the unfinished middle. As we established, McMurtry gave us the ultimate life value compass.
Mm-hmm.
But a compass doesn't provide a process ontology. It doesn't give a hospital administrator a causal model or a city planner a decision procedure for making, you know, really complex trade-offs. If you look around at modern institutions today, they constantly mistake their own internal measures of success for genuine human flourishing.
Right, because they lack a grammar for anything else.
Exactly. I mean, an economy uses gross domestic product as its metric of health. A healthcare system looks at treatment volume or billing codes. An education system looks at standardized test scores.
A credential accumulation.
Yeah. These are all what Sahali calls life-blind proxies. They measure the machinery, not the life the machinery is supposed to actually support.
Sure, I agree with the diagnosis. Right, so Sahali's proposed six-layer architecture is designed to fix this. It maps a dynamic process flow. It moves from a need to a satisfier, to a provision flow profile, to assimilation, and finally arrives at capacity and viability. Think of it like structural engineering. Okay, you can't just talk about the abstract laws of physics. You have to translate them into practical blueprints, load-bearing calculations, and stress tests to ensure a bridge won't collapse during rush hour. Without Sahali's architecture, we have no objective way to prove, with actual empirical teeth, when an institution is actively disabling life.
I come at it from a completely different way. Let me start by saying I do completely acknowledge the elegance of Sahali's framework. McMurtry's original diagnosis of what he termed the money sequence inversion is one of the most profound critiques of modern society we have.
Actually, for those listening who might not be familiar with that specific term, can you unpack the money sequence inversion real quick?
Of course. So think of it this way. Historically, human beings used money merely as a tool to get the things we needed to live.
A means to an end.
Exactly. The sequence was life leading to the means of life, leading to expanded life. Money was just a middleman. But the inversion happens when the math flips. Now the sequence is money leading to commodities, leading to expanded money.
Right.
Under this inverted sequence, human lives, our communities, our ecological support systems, they are treated merely as raw inputs and, well, externalized waste just to multiply money. We cut down an ancient forest not because we fundamentally need the shelter, but because we need the capital from the timber to generate quarterly returns.
The life becomes the means rather than the end.
Exactly. And Sahali is trying to cure that inversion. But here is where I really want to raise a massive alarm.
Okay.
There is an inherent contradiction in trying to standardize things like felt valence and subjective meaning. I mean, the white paper itself admits that the metaphysical hard problem of consciousness remains totally unresolved.
Sure. Nobody has solved that.
Right. We do not fully understand how subjective experience arises from physical matter. Yet, despite admitting this, the paper just proceeds to establish a minimal operational grammar and falsifiable middle-range hypotheses to measure these exact states of being.
And you see that as a fatal overreach.
I see it as inadvertently inviting domain collapse. Look, Sahali explicitly warns against institutional capture. He warns against what he calls interpretive sovereignty, the idea of one group getting to decide what life means for everyone else.
Yeah, he's very clear about that danger.
He is, but by constructing a comprehensive life knowledge commons, equipped with standardized instruments and these rigid decision procedures, he is practically handing a blueprint to technocrats. It gives administrative bodies the exact tools they need to claim objective scientific authority over what constitutes a valid human need. We risk replacing the tyranny of the financial auditor with the tyranny of the life value auditor.
Look, I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective on this minimal operational grammar, because you brought up domain collapse. The entire point of this specific grammar is to prevent domain collapse.
How so?
Well, Sahali identifies 7 minimal distinctions that absolutely must be made for interdisciplinary life value inquiry to function at all. For instance, we have to separate a need from a satisfier from a preference. If you don't enforce that distinction, you get massive category errors.
But who defines the need versus the preference? That's the issue.
The lived capacity does. Right now, conventional economics constantly confuses consumer preference with objective need. It assumes that if you buy a heavily marketed, ecologically destructive commodity, say a fast fashion garment, you have satisfied a need.
Okay. Yes.
In reality, you have merely satisfied an induced preference while simultaneously damaging the actual life capacity of the workers who made it and the watershed where the fabric was dyed. Furthermore, the grammar separates static states from what Sahali calls the regenerative margin.
Right. Capacity minus load.
Exactly. Regenerative margin is your total capacity minus the load you are currently carrying. This distinction allows us to see when a system is running at the absolute brink of collapse. Think of an emergency room nurse working a 14-hour shift.
A very relevant example, yeah.
Right? If you just look at a static state, she is upright, she is administering medicine, the system looks functional. But if you look at the regenerative margin, you realize she is operating at a massive deficit. One more patient, one more crisis, and she breaks. This grammar isn't a straitjacket. It's a shared vocabulary that forces disciplines to be incredibly precise about what they are actually measuring.
I mean, that is a compelling argument for the 7 distinctions, but have you considered the application of the 4 mandatory qualifiers? Because this is where the straitjacket actually gets tightened.
The qualifiers? Sure.
The framework requires every single substantive claim about life value to be marked by 4 things: domain, epistemic status, scale, and time.
Which provides necessary context, doesn't it?
In theory, yes, the intention is to avoid confusing reflective domains. The paper references the biologist Humberto Maturana here, warning that a biological description doesn't settle a political norm. But let's look at what this actually demands. Let's take just one of those qualifiers, scale.
Okay, let's look at scale.
What is a deeply restorative life value for a local watershed might be disastrous for a regional agricultural grid. The framework forces you to map that friction. But forcing diverse, messy, phenomenological realities to squeeze into these highly structured boxes, it risks flattening the complexity of the life ground.
I don't think it flattens it. I think it...
But you are asking qualitative first-person lived experiences to submit to a grammar that was fundamentally designed for third-person causal observation. When you demand that an indigenous community's subjective experience of cultural displacement be categorized under a specific epistemic status and temporal scale just so it can be inputted into a life value matrix, you aren't capturing their lived reality. You are distilling it into a data point that fits the administrative machine.
I hear the concern about distillation. I really do. But if we refuse to standardize the grammar across domains, aren't we just surrendering to the status quo?
Not necessarily.
We are. Right now, economics dictates global values simply because its math is the most universally understood. Economics has a highly standardized grammar. Prices, supply and demand curves, yield rates, GDP. It dominates global governance because it provides a unified language that scales.
Yes, a very flawed language.
Exactly. Flawed but dominant. If the life sciences, the social sciences, and phenomenological advocates refuse to adopt a shared discipline grammar to articulate life value, they will continue to lose every single policy battle to the economists. So Holly's grammar isn't about ignoring the qualitative or, you know, colonizing epistemology. It's about giving human and ecological realities the structured weight necessary to fight back against the totalizing force of the money sequence.
But by adopting the master's tools to dismantle the master's house, you run the very real risk of just building an identical house under a different name. The moment you force an organic relationship with the natural world into the rigid categories of need, satisfier, and regenerative margin, you are fundamentally altering how that relationship is understood and governed.
That's an interesting point, though I would definitely frame it differently. The grammar is a bridge, not an eraser. Let's look at how the framework handles the dynamics of provision, because I think this answers your concern about flattening reality. One of the most brilliant operational additions in this paper is the identification of flow as the missing temporal grammar.
The provision flow profile.
Yes. The paper argues that a satisfier is not valuable simply because it exists as a static object on a shelf, right? Water available once is not sustained hydration. A single 15-minute consultation is not healthcare.
Right.
Flow tracks the quantity, the quality, the timing, and the continuity of provision. And this leads to Sahali's operational taxonomy of satisfiers, which I think is absolutely vital for governance.
Where he divides them into genuine, pseudo, and counter-satisfiers.
Exactly. We must distinguish a genuine satisfier, like accessible primary care that actually builds long-term patient capacity, from a pseudo-satisfier. A pseudo-satisfier produces the felt signal of satisfaction without actually resolving the underlying need.
Like doom scrolling?
Yes. Algorithmic attention capture on social media. It simulates social connection and triggers dopamine, but it actually increases isolation. And even worse than that is the counter-satisfier. A counter-satisfier meets a surface need, but actively worsens the underlying condition over time.
Like using high-interest debt to survive.
Yes. If you're listening right now, imagine a single mother who has to use a credit card with a 30% interest rate just to buy groceries for her kids. Traditional economics looks at that transaction and says, great, a commodity was purchased, GDP goes up, she got the food.
The food is the satisfier.
But Saley's framework looks at the debt attached to it and labels it a counter-satisfier. The immediate need for calories is met, sure, but the financial load extracts her future regenerative capacity. Flow and this taxonomy allow us to objectively prove that mere aggregate provision is totally insufficient for life value.
Look, I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that it works that cleanly in practice. Let me tell you why.
Okay.
The theoretical elegance of distinguishing a pseudo-satisfier from a counter-satisfier is undeniable in an academic vacuum. But who decides when a partial satisfier crosses the threshold to become a counter-satisfier in real-time governance?
The empirical data would.
But if we shift from a simple, albeit deeply flawed metric like GDP, to these complex multi-dimensional vectors of provision flow profiles and assimilated provision, we are creating an administrative nightmare. Let's look at the math the paper introduces. I mean, Saheli proposes a literal differential equation for capacity changes.
The DC over DT equation.
Right. For those who haven't read it, the equation essentially says that the change in a system's capacity over time, DC over DT, equals the function of assimilated provision and repair minus the function of load and accumulated harm.
Yes.
It forces an institution to ask, did this intervention just fix a symptom today, or did it actually build capacity for tomorrow? As a theoretical scaffold, it is beautiful. But human behavior and ecological responses are deeply volatile. They are nonlinear.
Well, of course.
So when a government agency is tasked with optimizing that equation, they will inevitably have to define precise numerical values for assimilated provision and accumulated harm. The moment they do that, they have to rely on proxies. And the moment they rely on proxies, we are right back to the exact same metric gaming Saheli is trying to escape. Goodhart's law takes over.
Ah, when a measure becomes a target, it ceases to be a good measure.
Precisely. Think about how this plays out in a school district. A superintendent is told to measure assimilated educational provision. How do they do that? They can't measure the infinite complexity of a child's expanding mind. So they defined assimilated provision as standardized test scores just to make the math work. The equation becomes a theoretical scaffold that might fail catastrophically when applied to volatile institutional realities.
Let me push back on that, because the paper actually anticipates this exact critique. Saheli explicitly states the equation is a heuristic scaffold for model construction. It is not a universal numerical law that you just plug blind data into.
But institutions will treat it like one.
Not necessarily, because it is meant to enforce a vector-valued assessment. It prevents administrators from prematurely collapsing complex effects into a single score like a test result. Furthermore, you are worried about decision-making becoming a subjective, administrative nightmare, but Saheli provides a very specific lexical decision procedure to handle these complex vectors. It's an 8-step threshold-sensitive procedure.
Which is where things get even more rigid, frankly.
But necessary. Let's talk about the crown jewel of this procedure, the anti-displacement test. The framework forces us to look at nested scales. If a policy improves capacity here in our town, the anti-displacement test asks, well, who bears the indirect loads?
Right.
What happens in adjacent ecosystems? What options are systematically closed off for future generations? Let me use an analogy here. Traditional economics is like playing a game of Jenga, where you are only judged by whether you successfully pull out a single block. You build a dam, you get electricity, you get points.
Sure.
The anti-displacement test forces you to calculate the structural integrity of the entire Jenga tower before you touch the block. In traditional economics, downstream ecological damage is brushed off as an externality, a peripheral footnote that doesn't affect the core valuation of a profitable enterprise. Saheli brilliantly transforms those externalities into central, disqualifying evidence of life value failure.
If they can measure it.
If a hospital increases its patient throughput by burning out its nursing staff and pushing unpaid care onto families at home, the anti-displacement test catches it. It disqualifies that aggregate gain as a net life value gain.
That assumes the institution running the test actually has the epistemic humility and political will to accurately map all those indirect loads. The institutional realization of this procedure happens through what the paper calls the civil commons and life capital, and the procedure relies heavily on lexical ordering.
Meaning, certain conditions must be met absolutely before you can move to the next step.
Exactly. For example, rule number 4 in the procedure dictates that you must restore damaged capacities and regenerative margins before you can demand further performance from a system. Rule number 2 says you must protect universal necessity floors.
Right.
That sounds utterly perfect on paper.
But in the messy reality of resource scarcity, this lexical ordering could completely paralyze decision-making. If you literally cannot demand performance or prioritize new development until all damaged capacities are universally restored, how does a developing nation build critical energy infrastructure?
Well, they would have to...
How does a public health system function during a pandemic when everything is operating at a deficit? The demand for perfect non-displacement and perfectly restored margins creates a standard of purity that no actual human institution can meet.
It sounds like you view the anti-displacement test as a sort of infinite regress, like trying to map every single ripple before you throw a stone into a pond, which ultimately prevents you from ever throwing the stone at all.
That is an excellent way to put it, actually. And a paralyzed institution cannot provide the flows of life goods that the framework itself demands.
But let's look at the alternative. Throwing the stone without mapping the ripples is exactly how we arrived at the current planetary crisis. We threw the stone of fossil fuel industrialization without mapping the ripples of atmospheric carbon displacement.
That is true.
We threw the stone of algorithmic social media without mapping the ripples on adolescent psychological capacity. The anti-displacement test isn't demanding omniscience. The paper explicitly states that uncertainty is not a reason for paralysis.
But it demands a lot of certainty.
It demands a reasonable scope proportional to the stakes. It requires decisions to report confidence intervals, plausible mechanisms, and triggers for revision. It forces institutions to build channels through which previously invisible consequences become actionable. If mapping the ripples slows down the throwing of the stone, that is a feature, not a bug, of a life-coherent system.
That is a fair distinction regarding proportional scope, but it leads directly to my final overarching concern, which is institutional capture.
Capture, yeah.
The paper proposes a life knowledge commons to govern this framework, but any system that establishes universal floors, determines what counts as a genuine satisfier, and arbitrates these anti-displacement tests will hold immense, almost unimaginable power. Even if it is designed to be a plural, contestable knowledge infrastructure, power inevitably centralizes.
You think corporations will just co-opt the language?
Absolutely. Entities will spend billions lobbying to have their highly processed food products classified as genuine satisfiers rather than pseudo-satisfiers. They will fund massive, opaque studies to prove their ecological extraction passes the anti-displacement test. I have said it before, and I will maintain it. The diagnosis of the money sequence inversion is profoundly accurate, but codifying living coherence runs the eternal risk of institutionalizing a new orthodoxy that can just be bought and sold by the highest bidder.
Well, we have covered incredible ground today. To summarize my position, I believe SALI's operational completion is the absolutely necessary constitutional architecture required to save life value ontoxiology from being mere idealism. A compass is useless if you don't know how to navigate the ship. By providing a measurable process model incorporating flow, regenerative margin, and the anti-displacement test, this paper gives healthcare, education, and economics the empirical teeth they need. It provides the rigorous methodology required to actually choose the life sequence over the money sequence in daily practice. It moves LVOA from a philosophical critique into an actionable blueprint for civilization.
And to summarize my caution, while I deeply respect the underlying LVOA criteria, we must remember that no metric, no matter how holistically designed or mathematically elegant, can fully substitute for the unquantifiable lived reality of the human beings it attempts to measure.
Right. The attempt to codify living coherence, to measure meaning, and to mandate lexical decision trees, well, it risks creating a vast technocratic apparatus. We must be incredibly vigilant that in trying to cure the money sequence inversion, we do not inadvertently construct a system that totalizes interpretation and flattens the pluralistic complexity of human and ecological life into a new administrative grid.
Despite our deep disagreements on the risks of operationalizing this philosophy, I think we both find immense convergence around what the paper terms the Sahali methodological triality.
Yes, definitely.
This triality is meant to guide anyone using the framework by asking three fundamental things. Does this protect, restore, or enlarge life? What evidence would genuinely change our minds? And, crucially, Never fall in love with coherence more than reality.
I wholeheartedly agree with that triality. That third point, never falling in love with the coherence of your model over the messy reality of the world, it provides a safeguard against the very dogmatism I fear. Exploring how multiple domains, from public health to agriculture to economics, map onto this framework without losing their soul is vital, urgent work.
If you are listening right now, we encourage you to reflect on your own professional or academic field. Look at the metrics that govern your daily work. Are they aligning with genuine life capacity, or are they life-blind proxies serving a different master?
A great question to ask.
The ultimate verdict on whether LVOA can be successfully operationalized without losing its essence won't be settled in an academic white paper. It will be settled in the ongoing friction of reality. Returning to where we began, a compass cannot steer the ship, but perhaps if we are incredibly careful, fully transparent, and willing to constantly check our blueprints against the actual currents of lived experience, we can build a vessel capable of navigating by it.